A rested child is a happy child. Sleep Tight Stories is a weekly podcast that brings comfort and joy to families worldwide with calming bedtime stories. The stories are relevant to children and spark wonder without overstimulation, so they can fall asleep and stay asleep. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or a bedtime routine you'll miss when they're grown? Sleep Tight Stories.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our discussion of the history of toilet technology. In the last episode, you should probably go back if you haven't and listen to that episode first before you listen to this one. That's where we get all into the history of toilets in ancient civilizations, into latrine tech, into the Cloaca Maxima, the maximum sewer of
just
ancient
sailing
Rome.
Sailing a ship right through it.
Today we're going to get more into directly into the invention of the flush toilet. And I think we got to start off today by dispelling a common myth. That myth, and I've heard this like repeated in movies and stuff. It seems to be a thing people actually do think, is that the flush toilet was invented by a Mr. Thomas Crapper. Now, Crapper does play a role in the history of the toilet, but he is not its inventor by any means whatsoever. Not even close.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, we can debate about what it means to have a flush toilet if we're going to be discussing the idea of its invention. I'd say by some definitions, since waste was like washed away by water, you could argue that some peoples of like ancient Rome and the ancient Indus Valley had flush toilets. But that's not usually what we mean when we say a flush toilet. We usually mean a device that automatically removes waste with a simple mechanism. It's not like a hole over a drain pipe in which you can pour water. It's not something that constantly has water running underneath it. It's a machine with a mechanical flushing action that doesn't need to be situated over like a flowing ditch or anything like that.
And so there are a number of technologies that really need to be in place for this to come together. Like your plumbing technology has to reach the appropriate level of advancement before you can attach a toilet, as we – a modern flushing toilet to the scenario.
And make it practical, yeah. And right. This is going to be a big problem with the earliest models of the flush toilet. So to see one of the the first real flush toilet in the sense we mean, but an impractical early model, we need to meet a poet. And I think that it is appropriate that the first real flush toilet was created by a poet. We mentioned him in the last episode. Enter Sir John Harrington. So Sir John Harrington was an English courtier and an author who lived from 1560 or 1561 to 1612. His life story is that his father had repeatedly sort of married up into royal circles. First, his dad married one of Henry VIII's illegitimate daughters, and then later his father married a woman who served Queen Elizabeth I before she was queen. And this seems to be what led to Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, becoming John Harrington's godmother, though apparently Little John Harrington was a troublesome godson. He was prone to writing on embarrassing and morally impure subjects that repeatedly got him in trouble with the crown. He wrote insulting stuff about other kind of, you know, pompous court people. As for his literary works, he was probably best known for his translation of the Italian poet Ludovico Ariosto's epic Orlando Furioso.
Yeah.
And we can come back and mention that in a minute. But that's like a – doesn't Orlando Furioso – it's got like a big – dragon slaying thing in it. I'm trying to remember. I know I came across it when I was in school.
That sounds familiar. I feel like I read it in school as well, but I don't recall much about it. But at any rate, this Harrington guy, that sounds a little bit like he was kind of a brat.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, I mean, so he wrote these poems and epigrams, and hoo boy, you know, you can find these online. I don't know, maybe something's lost in the mix here, but if this guy considered himself a poet first, I really hope his toilets were good. So the poems are full of like really obvious groan-inducing turns of phrase, and then all these kind of catty burns on other courtiers who he gives these like classical influence nicknames like Sextus and Itus. Hmm. It seems to me at least like Harrington was sort of kind of a fan of himself. Like he thought he was pretty cool. Robert, do you feel like reading a couple of his short little poems here?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Okay. So this is one he wrote called A Comparison of a Book with Cheese. Old Heywood writes and proves in some degrees that one may well compare a book with cheese. Every market some buy cheese to feed on. At every mart some men buy books to read on. All sorts eat cheese, but how? There is the question. The poor for food, the rich for good digestion. All sorts read books, but why, will you discern? The fool to laugh, the wiser sort to learn. The sight, taste, scent of cheese to some is hateful. The sight, taste, sense of books to some's ungrateful. No cheese there was that ever pleased all feeders. No book there is that ever liked all readers.
Yeah, I already hate this guy.
You're about to like him even better. Here, this one's just a short four-line epigram here. It's called Against Writers That Carp at Other Men's Books.
This one sounds like there's a little venom in this.
Yeah. The readers and the hearers like my books, but yet some writers cannot them digest. But what care I? For when I make a feast, I would my guests should praise it, not the cooks.
Okay.
So it's an ABBA rhyme scheme there.
Yeah.
But I think he's saying like, hey, I don't write for the critics. I write for the fans, man.
I don't know. I mean, maybe this is all just like if we think of the like the literary scene at the time as being like kind of you know, kind of like a, you know, like a feud-driven hip-hop culture, then maybe, you know, that's probably the place for all of this.
Well, there's some of that. I mean, I get the feeling that he was sort of like a, you know, a man about the court. He was like within the scene. He had all these relationships. His poems are very like gossipy and they're full of all these burns and stuff. You get the sense they were sort of written not for a wide audience, but for a select audience who would get the, you know, who he is anonymously sending his burns at. I also notice how a lot of his work is about how his poetry is good, how his critics are dumb, and about food and comparing things to food. It's kind of Weird Al-ish.
I was really thrown back by the idea that the poor eat cheese for food, but the rich only eat cheese for digestion. I'm missing something there.
Yeah, it's like the rich don't eat food. What? Seems like it reveals some kind of attitude I can't quite put my finger on.
Plus, eating nothing but cheese sounds exactly like the kind of thing that some, upper class royal would do and then be, you know, gouty for it.
Didn't Henry VIII die of a surfeit of cheese?
Yeah.
So John Harrington, little godson of Queen Elizabeth I, John Harrington, he's busy at court. He's trying not to get caught up in political rat traps, and there's a lot of those going on right now. You know, there are all these plots and stuff. He gets in trouble anyway. He writes some terrible poetry, at least in my opinion. I should point out that around the same time that Shakespeare is writing his plays and Christopher Marlowe. And at one point, Harrington addresses some of his little barbs and epigrams to somebody named Faustus.
Oh.
I have to wonder if Christopher Marlowe is the target.
Solid burn referring to him as the this great work that he would forever be remembered for.
Right.
Yeah. And yet we don't. We didn't even name the toilet after Harrington. So
I decree all the toilets in the land will be named Harrington's.
All right. So how does he get around to inventing the toilet? It sounds like he has a pretty full plate with all of this these promos that he's cutting on other literary figures.
Well, he's getting in. So he gets in and out of trouble. Like apparently one of the – I mentioned earlier the thing he's most famous for historically is this translation of Orlando Furioso. Apparently the way the story goes is that he had translated one particularly racy passage and he was sharing it around with ladies of the court. And Queen Elizabeth was not amused. Mm-hmm. And as punishment for his bawdy behavior and his corruption of good ladies, she told him he would be banished from the court and that he shouldn't bother returning unless he had finished translating the entire epic poem. So he did. He finished the translation and he came back, only to get banished again some years later for insults and toilet humor. So sometime in this whole mix, it was in like the 1590s, it seems, I think maybe around 1594 or so, he actually invented the flush toilet. He put together the plan for one and he installed one in his home. And then later he actually installed one for Queen Elizabeth herself at her home at Richmond Palace in what was then Surrey. And we have some details on this because in 1596, Harrington publishes his notes on the invention of the flush toilet in a very strange book-length text called A New Discourse on a Stale Subject Called The Metamorphosis of Ajax.
Okay.
So this book is part description of an invention and part like satire and then part meditation on excrement and related subjects and a lot of like – it seems like a big part of it is just like a defense of him publishing the book that you're currently reading. I was trying to understand like what the real vibe of this work is and it just seems extremely odd. The title is kind of interesting. What's the deal with the metamorphosis of Ajax? Harrington apparently referred to the flush toilet he had invented as Ajax, as in like A-J-A-X, the character in the Iliad, right? You know, the great Greek warrior.
Yes.
And so apparently this is a pun on the word jakes, which was already at the time a slang word for a toilet. Obviously, it wouldn't be a flush toilet, but for like, you know, normal types of like pit toilets and stuff, it would be like go into the jakes or, you know, I'm going to go sit on the jakes. It's kind of like I need to use the John.
Oh, all right. So now we have the clever nature of the title is revealed. But it's still weird. It still makes me wonder yeah. what stage his syphilis was at the time.
Well, maybe we should take a quick break. And then when we come back, we will discuss the details of Harrington's invention, this flush toilet model.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart.
Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep tight stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So we have a bratty, privileged court poet who has managed to invent, well ahead of its time, a flushing toilet.
Yeah, and wrote a book about it. He calls it Ajax. I do like that name. I mean, even though it's kind of a groan-inducing pun, a lot of what he seems to be doing is like groan-inducing humor. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I like the idea of the toilet being Ajax. It's this Achaean hero. Mm-hmm. So he's working on his water closet device. We should say that the water closet device that he made, the Ajax, it no longer exists. There aren't any like models you can find. I like to imagine it was dismantled and its parts used to make gifts for the French royal family. There aren't any today, but there are like replicas based on the description. And if you see one of these, it's like a huge two-level wooden box that looks sort of like an upright piano. And the box hides its inner workings inside these wood panels. Basically, it has two major parts. It's got a bowl that you do your stuff in. You know, you poop in the bowl, and then it's got a hole in the bottom of the bowl leading to a drainage pipe. And this drainage pipe could go wherever. At the time, of course, there was not like a organized plumbing and sewage system, so it would probably be going into like a pit, you know, mm-hmm. like a cesspit. And then above that, you've got a cistern that stores water, just like on the back of a – not exactly, but much like on the back of like a modern Western toilet. You've got right. a cistern where the flushing water is stored. The bowl itself was waterproofed with pitch and wax and resin. And so when you want to use the toilet, what you do is you lift a handle to release the stopper on the cistern above. So the cistern's got water on it. You release the stopper and this floods the bowl with water from the cistern. And then when you're done with your business, you lift a second handle and this releases a stopper at the bottom of the bowl, which allows its contents to flow out into the drain pipe. And we should again emphasize, we talked about this in the last episode, that while we're focusing on the toilet itself today, like the sewer system that supports a toilet is the probably even more important invention for public sanitation because that, you know, that's necessary. Like a flush toilet that simply drains to the outdoors or something like that, it leads to some of the same problems as other non-flushing methods like just throwing a chamber pot out the window. At the time of Harrington's invention, there was obviously not a modern sewer system in England. So this may have been an improvement of personal convenience like within your home, but it wasn't making the public sanitation issue any better. But as popular as like indoor flush toilets are today, you might guess, okay, so this was immediately an overnight sensation, right? Everybody wanted these things.
And that's simply not the case.
No, not at all. So we only have evidence that Harrington ever built two of them. He built the one for himself and the other one for Queen Elizabeth. And this is probably so there are some serious problems with its design, right? First, each flush required a ton of water. Like it required about 7.5 gallons or 28 liters of water every single flush. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to find some way because they didn't have indoor plumbing at the time. You know, you'd have to find some way to constantly refill the cistern with water if you wanted to keep flushing, maybe manually with buckets or something. I don't know. And then, so of course, that's troublesome work. And then a workaround, of course, that Harrington suggested is that, you know, maybe people could just keep using the toilet without flushing it until it was so piled up that it was absolutely necessary.
Oh, kind of if it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Except he suggested, you know, maybe you might want to let like 20 people poop in it before you flush. because you know, it's just
a lot of water.
It's a lot of water. You got to carry that water up to the thing. This obviously just wasn't the most beautiful option. I'm sure Queen Elizabeth was not a huge fan of just letting the poop pile up in there. So it was also obviously expensive to have one of these things. And if you consider it, even though there was a mechanical stopper for the bowl drain, it probably would have smelled bad, you know, because you just get like stuff stuck in there and you'd have smells coming through. It just doesn't seem all that great of a design.
I'm reminded a lot of the jetpack in a way, you know, because today we have jetpacks. We've had jetpacks for decades.
Right.
But can everybody have a jetpack? Should everyone have a jetpack? Is the world properly is the world ready for everyone to have a jetpack? It's not. And in the same sense, yes, flush toilets existed. Here is the example. And yet, you know, clearly this was not scalable. Like this was something that it was more of a curiosity than anything.
Yeah, exactly. It was an extravagant, novel curiosity for the extremely wealthy. And it wasn't until a couple of hundred years afterwards that really anybody else started trying to build and use flush toilets. Basically, almost nobody else used flush toilets until like the 1770s. So let's go to the 1770s then. So around 1775, a watchmaker named Alexander Cummings, files a patent for a flush toilet. And his design introduces a crucial improvement. And I think this is a pretty clever one. It introduces the S-trap. And this is an ingenious solution for preventing the toilet from becoming a gateway for the demons of odor hell to climb up into your home. Because if you've got like a pipe connecting your toilet that's inside your house to the pit where all of the poop goes, you know, you can imagine that there are going to be some smells coming up through it. So you would want to find a way to seal it off. In Harrington's water closet, the toilet bowl was sealed with this mechanical stopper plugging a hole in the bottom of the bowl. And after the bowl was flooded with water from the cistern above, you could operate a lever to unplug the stopper and release the contents into the pipe below. The S-trap is different. There, the seal between the bowl and the sewer pipe is not just a mechanical stopper, though Cummings' model did have a mechanical stopper. It was like a slide valve. But it's also a seal made of the water itself. So the way it works is like this. The drainage pipe where things leave the toilet, it has a sideways S-shaped bend in it. So take a capital S, flip it on its side. I guess it could be a lowercase s too, huh? You flip it on its side, and then it's always going to be filled with water in the lower part of the bend, right? So the reservoir of sitting water there in the bottom of the sideways S shape forms this perfect natural seal that prevents sewer gas from escaping up the pipes into your home. And so S traps like this are still used today in modern drains and drains for sinks and toilets. And so here's some toilet news you can use. If you have ever noticed that there's like an unused drain in your home that smells bad, it's likely because the trap, like the water in the trap has evaporated and it's no longer forming a seal against the sewer gases below. So the easy fix is to just run some fresh water down the drain to flood the trap again. So I like that. S-trap is very, very brilliant, elegant solution to a problem.
And yet at the same time, the Ajax is still undergoing its metamorphosis.
Right. Yes, it is not finished yet. The Ajax is still a kind of clunky, unwieldy figure, kind of like the Ajax of – well, I guess I'm trying to remember. I think of Ajax as kind of like big and buff and clunky. He was kind of graceful too, I guess.
You know, I'm not really remembering what Ajax – what his main contribution was.
Well, he's like a great warrior. He's one of the—
Oh, well, they all are.
Right, of course. But he, at the end, he gets into the argument with Odysseus about the armor, and then I think he loses the debate, and then he falls on his sword because I think Athena drives him mad or something. I don't know.
Tensions were running pretty high, and the gods were involved.
I gotta go back and read the Iliad again, I guess. But anyway, so we're talking about the Ajax machine. So there were some, even though you've got the S-trap, there were some kinks in Cummings' design that were worked out in later models by other inventors. Like, one problem was apparently that it had a sliding valve. So you imagine it's got a valve at the bottom of the toilet bowl that, you know, it's different than most of the toilets we see today because it actually had like a lid that would close on the bottom.
Yeah.
And this was like a sliding thing, and this was a problem because, of course, it could get gross and gunky.
Yeah, like one of the most beautiful aspects of the modern toilet is that there are no moving parts coming into contact with fecal matter
right.
if you're using it correctly.
Exactly. Yes, yes. That's a very good point. So it could get gross and gunky, and it could freeze, and that's not good. Mm. So this was later improved by being replaced with a downward opening flap valve, and the patent for this innovation went to a water closet installer and inventor named Joseph Brahma, though I think there might be some disagreement about whether Brahma himself actually invented this, you know, flap modification, but he held the patent for it. And then this model, the Brahma model, became popular and basically remained popular for those who could afford it until the mid-20th century. And it spread around like this did become like a kind of a sensation.
Yeah, this was the version of the technology that really spread and became a truly popular way to poop.
But as is often the case, I mean, part of the problem with the history of sanitation development and like indoor access to toilet facilities had to do with money, right? It was mm-hmm. like people who could afford to install these kinds of toilet facilities, they would have them, but a lot of people couldn't afford that.
Yeah, like it often reminds me of the fancy garbage can scenario. Mm-hmm. You know, like how much are you willing to pay for the thing in which you are going to put trash?
Right.
When a simpler model will do the job, you know?
Yeah.
So, for many people, the idea of a flushing toilet was just ludicrous for a number of reasons, most of which were financial.
But I think one of the big things that helped push toilet technology along was the development of sewer infrastructure to support it that made it not just a thing that's nice to have, not just a more aesthetically pleasing way to have a home, but also a major part of public health. And so like in the mid-19th century in London, for example, it's a good example because London's getting very crowded. You've got the Industrial Revolution. Crowded London was becoming just unbearable. And in many ways, because of its sewage and sanitation system. So you got a crowded city, lots of people are using chamber pots and just emptying them into the streets or where there are other generally uncontained ways of disposing of human waste. For example, water closets like the Brahma toilets, not connected to a dedicated sewage system for waste. Mm. In these methods, you just have sewage draining off into simple sewers that were originally designed to just accept and channel rainwater. And of course, then these sewers would later become sources of drinking water for other people, or the sewage would just end up in the River Thames and other water sources. So in this period, the city and the river just stank. Supposedly, it was awful. Like in 1850, the English magazine Punch published the cartoon I've got here of what was supposed to be like a close-up illustration of what a drop of water from the Thames must look like. And basically, it's full of like – it's got skeletal murder clowns and it's got this snapping turtle with big hug arms and it's got a Hieronymus Bosch-type bird man from Malabolga. It's just like crazy. I wish political cartoons were still this creative instead of just being like – some caricature of, you know, like an ugly guy that has like taxes written on him. But anyway, the point it's making is that, hey, we've got a problem. You know, the river that runs through the middle of our city is becoming absolutely filthy. And of course, during the first half of the 1800s, there were we've talked about on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before, frequent cholera outbreaks, all over the place. And whenever there's like crowded human civilization, but they were frequently going on in London. We did an episode about this epidemiological history in an episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind on miasma theory that you can go and check out. But the short story there is that a surgeon named John Snow in mid-19th century London eventually showed that the cause of these cholera outbreaks was the consumption of unclean water, which was tainted by mixing with sewage. And in the summer of 1858, all this septic horror culminated in this event that is known in history as the Great Stink, or the Great Stink of London, when the foul odor of the Thames in the city was just overwhelming. A commonly cited story about this period is that members of Parliament were so, like, panicked to get rid of the stink, they doused the curtains of their chamber in chloride of lime to try to counteract the smell. It's almost like, you know, I'll just huff some chlorine and see if that wards it away. But pretty soon after this, Parliament authorized the construction of a new sewer system. And of course, you know, it's like classic politician issues, right? Like there's a major public problem and then nothing gets done about it until it like personally affects them.
Mm-hmm. Until you're actually dousing your drapes with chlorine.
But of course, the installation of the sewer system was a great thing for England. During the 1860s and 70s, there was this engineer named Sir Joseph Bazalgette. He had plans for a contained sewer and drainage system. And during the 60s and 70s, these were built. And so the main benefit of the sewer system was that it would keep sewage separate from the water supply. And this, of course, was this huge revolution in public health. Like they found afterwards that, of course, well-drained areas that had the sewer system functioning and safely removing sewage were kept free from cholera epidemics that broke out in other areas in the following years. And I think this brings us to a major issue from this era that we need to consider about the toilet and about sewer systems. While the flush toilet in the form of the 19th century water closet, the Ajax, was a great invention in a way, it did not make things better on its own, or at least not in a public way, because simply flushing your untreated waste out into channels mingled with downstream drinking water actually makes things like worse than simply pooping in a pit latrine. In order to improve public health and save lives, the flush toilet couldn't exist on its own. It had to be paired with a safe, dedicated sewage system to deal with waste properly. It's only because of public infrastructure that the toilet could become all it could be.
Absolutely. It reminds me of our recent discussion of wheels.
Yeah.
You know, the wheel is great. The wheeled cart is great. But you've got to have roads. You've got to have some sort of system that allows you to maximize this technology.
This is a really common theme that's coming up in invention history, is that people often have this idea of, like, you know, technological revolutions happening because a lone inventor had a brilliant idea and that one idea changed everything. That seems like it's so rarely that that's the case. I mean, major technological revolutions tend very often to depend on large investments in public infrastructure to support the new technology.
That's an excellent point. And on that note, we're going to take one more break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about Thomas Crapper, and we're going to talk about the legacy of the flush toilet.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me!
Bet
he can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back. So it's time to talk about Thomas Crapper. We know now he did not invent the flush toilet, but what was the role of Mr. Thomas Crapper? And I noticed I was doing this when I was like making notes for this episode. I don't know why my brain keeps doing this, but I don't usually call random historical dudes Mr. when I type their names. Yeah. But I wonder if like talking about toilets makes me naturally tend toward sort of pointless formality. Maybe an interesting psychological thing to return
to. Or maybe you just feel weird referring to him as Crapper and you feel like you need to designate that you're talking about a person and you're not using a crude term for a toilet.
I'm distinguishing him from Dr. Thomas Crapper.
All right. Well, Thomas Crapper enters the picture in the 1860s. And basically what he does is he redesigns and supplies high-end plumbed-in products. So we're talking the likes of the cast iron bath shower combo, elaborate shower screens, cast iron pedestal wash bins. He installs some extra mirrors, hot and cold mixture taps. He improved the S-bin plumbing trap that we talked about in the 1880s and invented the U-bin plumbing trap.
Hmm.
This is all part of a large, it's not just one plumber going around doing all this. He founded Thomas Crapper and Company in London, a sanitary equipment company, and he held 9 patents, 3 for water closet designs, such as the floating ball cock inside the toilet tank. But he didn't actually patent a toilet. So we have to double down on what we said earlier. Not only did he not invent the toilet, he didn't even reinvent the toilet. But he did improve upon some of the details of the design.
Yeah, his major role seems to be more a case of like owning a business and practicing good branding than of actual invention. Everywhere around the world, people will associate my name with toilets. And apparently this happened because like, you know, you'd go and look inside toilets in Great Britain and they'd just say Crapper in them.
Yeah.
And this helped lead to people calling the toilet a Crapper in a vulgar way. Though you're probably now wondering, Thomas Crapper, is his name and association with the toilet the origin of the term crap, meaning human excrement? Before I looked this up, I was thinking, well, maybe it is. Maybe the term comes from his name and his association with the toilet.
Because it would seem a huge coincidence, right? That this guy who made his money off of the toilet would be named Crapper.
Actually, it just is a huge coincidence. The word crap does not come from his name. So the word crap comes in English. It comes from originally the old French crape or crape from the Middle Latin crapa, words meaning something like siftings or chaff. And so the original use of the word crap in English refers to things dropped or cast away or discarded. So you can see why this might come to mean excrement, right? It's the thing you throw away or shed.
Okay. So when we're using the word now and we're referring to our stuff as our crap, like that is actually the more authentic use of the word.
Kind of, yeah. It's the stuff that could be, you know, it's execrable.
Yeah. Like, I left all my crap at the hotel. Well, I've got to go back for that. that's the authentic use of crap.
Well, I don't know. If you really want it back, then maybe it's not crap. Though I guess you're just like being cynical there. You know, like, oh, it's all crap. I could lose it all. It doesn't matter. Funny enough, this also seems to be very similar to the etymology of another English word, which comes from the Anglo-Saxon skiton, in turn from the Proto-Germanic skit, meaning to cut or shear or split. In other words, to separate from the body.
Hmm.
And just because this sent me down a rabbit trail that I ended up finding interesting, the root of the English word science is also apparently somewhat related here. So the word science comes from Latin scientia or scientia, knowledge, and from scire or to know, which in Latin is probably derived from the Proto-Indo-European, which of course is like the granddaddy language of many languages around the world, ski or sky, meaning to cut or separate, because I think the logic of this word is when you know things, you separate fact from fiction. You separate truth from falsehood.
Hmm.
And so knowledge and science is sort of metaphorically a cutting and separating process. Another one of these wonderful examples of abstract words in language with concrete metaphorical roots. But anyway, whether you are crapping or sciencing, some part of you is cutting away and separating.
All right. Well, let's get to the modern toilet then. Let's get to the modern Western flushing toilet.
Okay.
What are we dealing with here?
Now, there, of course, are plenty of different designs for like what you do when it's time to use the toilet, right? And we can talk about those as we go on. But one of the features that I think many modern toilets can really boast about that's really cool is that they don't bother with solid valves at the bottom of the bowl.
Yes.
Some do, like some airplane toilets do.
Right. Yeah, but that's a whole different kettle of fish. We'll have to come back to airline toilets and space toilets in the future.
Right. Instead, in a lot of these modern toilets, it's all just water and pipe design, making use of the physics concept of a siphon. So, Robert, have you ever made a siphon?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Every time I use a drinking straw.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So, like, you know, of course, a siphon, like, you can put one bucket up on a counter and another bucket down on the floor, and you can, like, if you put a hose between them and you start sucking water up into the hose from the top one and then put the bottom of the hose in the bottom bucket, it'll drain all the way down, even though the water has to go up into the hose from the top bucket.
Yeah, I feel like if you've ever spent enough time playing with like one of those cheap yard swimming pools and a hose as a child, you probably did this.
Yeah. So in the most common model of like the modern Western toilet, there's always water sitting in the bowl, and the evacuation pipe where the stuff goes away from the bottom of the bowl, it curves up when it leaves the bowl. It curves up higher than the water level within the toilet before snaking back down under the floor. And this keeps the water sitting in the toilet without draining out when it's not being flushed. And it also forms a type of S-trap to block sewer gases from escaping into the house. So then when it's time to flush, water from the cistern is released down into the bowl. This raises the water level above the bend in the pipe, which of course causes the water to begin draining down into the lower part of the pipe, which sucks all the contents out of the bowl by the siphon action. And something about me just finds this a really beautiful and elegant solution. I love the fact that the toilet doesn't need to have a trap door or anything like that in the bottom of it. It's just a correctly shaped pipe.
Absolutely. And again, we should thank the universe every day that that is the case.
Yeah. And so another thing, of course, is that there are other components. Like you could talk about how the cistern tends to work in a toilet with a cistern. It tends to have components like a float, which is designed to measure the right amount of water to allow into the cistern. Like one of the things that Thomas Crapper held one of the patents for was the ball cock, right?
Mm-hmm,
which
yes.
Floats up and it like trips a switch that says, hey, you can stop filling the cistern with water now because the water level has reached the right level. And there's all that kind of stuff. But the basic principles of the toilet, while we don't often think about them, once you see how it works, it's actually very simple. It's very elegant. It's a beautiful machine.
Yeah, I will say that I'm not really a handy person at all, but I recently repaired the machinery in the tank of my toilet when something was off, and I was able to look up a video on YouTube, follow the instructions, make the repair myself, and I just felt like $1 million afterwards.
It's a great feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like fixing a water appliance.
Yeah, but then also it's like you can see it all working. Like it all makes sense. You know,
yeah.
when you can flush the toilet, watch these mechanisms move, watch the water level change. You can absorb it very easily.
But as we talked about in the last episode, the toilet is not just a beautiful and elegant machine to admire from a design point of view. Of course, it does provide a ton of convenience in our lives. But also, as we said last time, the toilet saves lives. We say it again, toilets save lives. This is a life and death issue. This is a major important technology that we need to improve access to all around the world.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we really have to stress the sanitation issues here. It reminds me of another issue with waste and the spread of illnesses and parasites, especially hookworms.
Mm-hmm.
Hookworms being a parasite that can cause illness in humans, and these will typically be acquired in, say, a latrine field. Parasites are acquired when bare feet come into contact with infected feces. They enter through the feet and they make their way into the host's intestines, resulting in anemia, malnutrition. And in the early 20th century, John D. Rockefeller funded a campaign to decrease hookworm infections in the American South. And one of the key methods was to impose latrine pits of at least 4 feet, as microscopic hookworms can travel up to 4 feet in soil from a site of defecation.
Yeah. And so this emphasizes again that, like, if you're not removing sewage to like a treatment facility or something like that, or, you know, there are all kinds of variables that come into play about how safe like a pit storage kind of thing can be. You want to keep it closed to prevent like flies and stuff from getting out. But also, if it's not sealed off from the ground soil, mm-hmm. if it's not dug deep enough, you can encounter problems as well.
Now, I have to stress that I do really love my current plumbing situation. And I really, especially after these episodes, I really am thankful for my functional toilet.
But I sense a but coming.
Yes.
You've got beef.
I do. And it's twofold. On one hand, there's the weirdness of the fact that when you flush a toilet, you are flushing, unless you have a gray water system hooked up in some way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. you are flushing drinking water. You are using perfectly drinkable water to send your urine and feces down into the sewer.
Yeah, it would be great if there was a gray water system for, yeah.
Right, and people have worked on it, and in some places these are in place.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in some parts of the world, you're going to have of toilet that is not using drinkable water to flush just by virtue of the availability of drinkable water.
Right.
Okay, so that's one ridiculous level. But the other is that the Western toilets have rebranded defecation as something that should be done from a seated position.
Uh-huh.
The throne, the chair, when naturally the human body evolved to defecate from a squatting position. And plenty of people still do it this way, especially in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Squat toilets can still be found all over the place in these areas, utilizing modern flushing aesthetics in many cases and functionality, but with the basic concept of squatting still in play.
I think squatting toilets are becoming trendy in the West too, aren't they?
Well, not full blown squatting toilets, uh-huh. where you squat over the floor-based apparatus.
Yeah.
You'll see more like the Squatty Potty, which I have a Squatty Potty. I love it. But it allows you to essentially use a Western throne toilet, mm-hmm. but with more of a squatting posture, which again is what our bodies evolved to do. Likewise, you can get some toilet seats that have room for your bare feet to rest on, so that you can squat over that. I've never used one of those, but I'm interested because that's basically how my son likes to use a toilet. So
uh-huh.
So maybe that's what I need to get him down the line. Now, toilet designs continue to evolve. We're utilizing high-tech bells and whistles typified by some of the Japanese toilets that you often see featured in videos.
Yeah. And, it's almost a cliche at this point, like the high-tech Japanese toilet.
Right. Yeah. Various buttons that you can push for – I mean, some of it makes perfect sense. Like being able to call for help from the toilet mm-hmm. is a great idea, especially if you're dealing with an elderly population.
One thing I've seen that I thought was kind of interesting was a I believe this was Japanese, but I'm not positive. But it was a toilet that has a built-in sort of like noisemaker.
Yes.
There's of course a common cultural phenomenon of people being embarrassed about the sounds they make when they're on the toilet in a place where people can hear them.
Right.
So if you're in a public bathroom in a stall or something, you're using a toilet, people will often just continuously flush the toilet because it's loud and that covers up the sounds of what they're doing. But that also wastes a lot of water. You don't need to do that. So a way around that is you can help accommodate people's sense of embarrassment and modesty without wasting all the water by just having a loud flushing sound play when you press a button.
Well, I think the Romans might have been onto something here with having live music in the toilet. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should go that route. Maybe not live music, but maybe just piped in like loud rock music.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that'll be better for everybody. You'll save money. I guess two other key innovations here. One that I think is excellent, and that is various low flush features, which helps save the amount of water, reduce the amount of water that you're doing to flush your business. Another innovation that I absolutely despise is the auto flush toilet,
in which a robotic sensor
will decide when you need a flush, and it almost, at least the ones that I've ever used, almost always decides to flush at the absolute wrong time.
Yeah,
and will end up flushing too many times, or just phantom flushing, with nobody in there.
There was a toilet in the building here one time that I encountered that was just forever flushing. It was stuck in Eterniflush. Mm-hmm. It never stopped.
Like I end up wasting extra toilet paper because my first step is to mask the sensor with toilet paper to wrap – to give it a blindfold so that it won't scare me. I don't need to feel like a predator is about to attack me while I'm doing my business. And I've done the same when I've had to take my son to the toilet. It's like it's going to scare him. It's just ridiculous. It's a great idea ultimately, but I think the sensor technology is not quite there.
Are you the person who keeps vandalizing the auto toilets in our building?
There's no need to vandalize them. I want to stress that.
Because people do literally take them apart.
Yeah, but there's no need to do that. You can just wrap some toilet paper around their sensor, blindfold the toilet, and it'll be fine. Now, another interesting bit of difference in cultural toilet design is the Flachspüler plate in older German toilets.
Oh, what's this?
Did you ever encounter any of these?
I don't think so.
So I got to experience some of these when I went on a high school trip to Germany back, I guess it was like the late 90s. Mm-hmm. They weren't everywhere, but they were some of the places. And apparently you don't find as many anymore. Basically, it's very much just like any other Western toilet, except there's kind of a raised plate upon which the fecal matter will fall, and then when you flush, it's flushed away off of that little plate. And contrary to what you might have heard, these are not examination plates. That was kind of like not even an urban legend, but it was just like false information where people say, oh, that's so that you can poop and then you want to look at your poop and it's on a plate for you to see it.
Okay.
No, rather the feature was aimed at preventing you from splashing yourself with toilet water when you defecated.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a smart idea.
I agree, apparently you can design a toilet in such a way that maybe there's less splash without having to use the plate, because the drawback to the plate is that sometimes it requires more brushing of the toilet bowl. Now, speaking of toilet bowl innovation, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the infamous masculine toilet.
Oh, yes. This has been in the news.
Yeah. Championed by former acting United States Attorney General Matt Whitaker.
Yeah. He was representing some business that like they claim to sort of like be advocates on behalf of inventions. And one of the inventions that somebody was doing business with them with was this toilet for – how did they put it? What was the polite terminology?
Well-endowed men, I guess. The idea being that these men, their penises are longer, and if they sit on the toilet, their penis is going to get in the water of the toilet.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, they need more distance between seat and water, which, you know, I would argue that this could be avoided in plenty of other ways, such as you could use a squatty potty. I think that would probably help. Or just basic manipulation and awareness of one's own genitals.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't help but wonder, and maybe this is something that is detailed in the patent information or the literature surrounding the masculine toilet is, wouldn't it result in a maximum splashdown?
It's like a giant deep bowl, yeah.
Yeah, so it seems like, yeah, you can sit on the toilet and you can feel like you don't have to worry about your anatomy touching the water until, you know, the fecal matter drops like 5 feet and then splashes up like a torpedo went off. So I don't know. I have a lot of questions about the practicality of the masculine toilet.
I think it's only 12 inches, not okay. 5 feet. But that seems that's like the worst distance, right?
Yeah, that seems like that would be maximum splashdown distance.
Yeah.
If it were 5 feet, yeah, you'd be fine. You don't have to climb up a ladder to get on your toilet. And then it would make you look like a tiny person on a giant toilet, which probably runs against like the masculine impulse of the design, right?
I'd have to imagine if anybody actually bought something like that, it was probably not someone who literally needed it.
They needed the world to think they needed it. But maybe we're wrong. Hey, if anyone listening out there has used a masculine toilet, let us
do
know.
Do not email us. Do not. I don't want to hear about it.
I seriously do want to hear about anybody, any kind of toilet we've discussed here, any kind of latrine situation, if you have insightful experience with them, be it squat toilets, squatty potties, dry latrines, wet latrines, washing versus wiping. I want to hear about all of it. You know, we can withhold the names as necessary.
Okay, I got to finish today with a great story about toilet technology and a flush fiasco
okay.
from the 20th century history. Do you want to hear about when a toilet sank a Nazi submarine?
Oh, yes, please.
So had you come across this story before?
I had not. No, I hadn't really thought much about U-boats and toilets, really.
Oh, I mean, yeah, that's inherently a fascinating subject, right? So on April 14th, 1945, you had a German U-boat called U-1206 that was forced to surface after a German officer screwed up the toilet and caused poison gas to vent into the crew areas. So fortunately, we know this officer's name and he will be remembered in history. The officer was named Captain Lieutenant Carl Adolf Schlitt. And the submarine was so it was traveling submerged, I think, in the North Sea. It was off the coast of Scotland. And this particular U-boat had been fitted with a new model of underwater toilet that was supposed to work at greater depths, I think. And there might be some kind of pressurization issue going on.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Anyway, for whatever reason, it was a new model of toilet. And the story goes that Schlitt did his business on this new high-tech toilet, but couldn't figure out how he was supposed to flush it. So he called in tech support. And the engineer who arrived apparently pulled the wrong lever or something, operated the machine incorrectly, and seawater flooded in. And it soaked a bunch of electrical batteries underneath the toilet, which in turn started releasing poisonous chlorine gas into the cabin. And then the boat was forced to go to the surface to ventilate with the outside air because of the poison gas. But it was in enemy waters off the coast of Scotland, and Allied aircraft quickly attacked it. Then the boat was damaged and the crew was forced to abandon ship. Somehow I'm sure this is not the only case in history of critical problems caused by pooping on a submarine. It had to have happened before, but this is the story of Carl Adolf Schlitt.
Ha. Huh. That is interesting. I'd never heard that one before. But like this was the new model.
Yeah.
Perhaps it was invented because of previous problems. So there was perhaps a whole string of other U-boat or just general submarine bathroom issues. I mean, we've covered on the show before, and stuff to blow your mind anyway, the history of toilets in orbit, toilets in microgravity, and like that's a whole engineering fiasco unto itself.
Yeah, but it's also amazing. I mean, if you ever wanted to poop into a vacuum cleaner,
yeah, as opposed to just pooping into a bag, which was the earlier option, yeah.
Right. Everybody has wanted to poop into a vacuum cleaner. Who hasn't thought about that?
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there with pooping into the vacuum cleaner because it does make you wonder, like, what does the future hold for the toilet? To what extent have we reached peak toilet? I mean, we do see new models, new innovations coming out every year. There are toilet companies that depend on finding new twists, pushing new designs. So I wonder what humans will be pooping into in say 100 years, 200 years.
Yeah, one thing I could mention in my research, I came across – there was an article that had a quote from a Dutch architect named Rim Koolhaas. Mm-hmm. And he said that the toilet – this is the way he put it. It's the fundamental zone of interaction on the most intimate level between humans and architecture.
Yeah, okay.
I can kind of see that. Yeah, it's almost like where we're built, because like you got other furniture in your house, mm-hmm. but you move that around usually, or you don't have such a deeply intimate relationship with it as you do with the toilet.
Right, usually not.
Yeah.
but you know, most people do not have a carnal relationship with their furniture.
Right.
But everybody has a very intimate relationship with the toilet.
Yeah. So I like thinking about it like that. It's almost like it's the, you know, we mentioned earlier that like the S pipe is sort of like the sentry that the trap, whatever it is, mm-hmm. the water trap, that the sentry that guards the gates and doesn't let demons from odor hell come up into your house. The toilet is also sort of like a diplomat. It's how you interface with the world of infrastructure beyond most deeply and most fundamentally. It's how you interface your body with the sewer. It's communion with the arteries of civilization and modern sanitation.
It does make me wonder, however, how do the toilets on the Starship Enterprise work? Do you think they're like teleporter based?
Well, I would guess that they probably just atomize the stuff and turn it into raw materials to be used in the replicator. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's just atoms. Why not?
Yeah.
No problem with that.
I mean, poop is unclean, but atoms aren't unclean.
That's right. You reduce everything to its basic atoms, it's all good.
And it only takes the energy of like 30,000 nuclear bombs.
All right. Well, again, we'd love to hear from everyone out there if you have any insight on the evolution of the toilet technology across the ages, and indeed where it'll go in the future. Perhaps there is a wonderful treatment of science fiction toilets out there, and we'd love to hear about that as well. If you want to check out other episodes of Invention, head on over to inventionpod.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes. You'll find links out to our various social media accounts. If you want to talk about the show with other listeners and with us, you should look up Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. It's a Facebook group, and really, it's like the only thing I use Facebook for. I'll do some family photos for my own private stuff, but then as far as like sharing things on Facebook, I feel like I generally just share them there. So go there. It's a cool place. Let's see, what else? Oh, yeah, you can also buy an Invention merchandise if you want. We have our cool logo. You can get that on a shirt or on a sticker. And the best thing you can do is just simply make sure you have subscribed to the show and then rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so.
Absolutely. Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for a future, to tell us finally how to use the 3 seashells, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia.
and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.